ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो देवासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
श्रीमद् भगवद् गीता चैप्टर 2 Text 46, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Yavanartha udapane,
sarvata samplutodake,
tavan sarveshu vedeshu, brahmanasya Brahmanasya vijanatah.
Brahmanasya vijanatah.
Yavan artha udapane. Sarvata samplutodake. Tavan sarveshu vedeshu. Brahmanasya vijanatah. All purposes served by a small well can at once be served by a great reservoir of water. Similarly, all the purposes of the Vedas can be served to one who knows the purpose behind them. Purport. The rituals and sacrifices mentioned in the Karma Kanda division of the Vedic literature are meant to encourage gradual development of self-realization. And the purpose of self-realization is clearly stated in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The purpose of studying the Vedas is to know Lord Krishna, the primeval cause of everything. Self-realization means understanding Krishna and one's eternal relationship with Him. The relationship of the living entities with Krishna is also mentioned in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The living entities are parts and parcels of Krishna. Therefore, revival of Krishna consciousness by the individual living entity is the highest perfectional stage of Vedic knowledge. This is confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam as follows. Ahobata shvapachoto gariyan yajjivagre vartate namatu bhyam te pustapaste juhuvu sasnur arya brahman uchur nama grinantiyete brahman uchur nama grinantiyete. O my Lord, a person who is chanting your holy name, although born of a low family, like that of a chandala, dog eater, is situated on the highest platform of self-realization. Such a person must have performed all kinds of penances and sacrifices according to Vedic rituals and studied the Vedic literatures many, many times after taking his bath in all the holy places of pilgrimage. Such a person is considered to be the best of the Aryan family. So one must be intelligent enough to understand the purpose of the Vedas without being attached to the rituals only, and must not desire to be elevated to the heavenly kingdoms for a better quality of sense gratification. It is not possible for the common man in this age to follow all the rules and regulations of the Vedic rituals, nor is it possible to study all of the Vedanta and the Upanishads thoroughly. It requires much time, energy, knowledge, and resources to execute the purpose of the Vedas. This is hardly possible in this age. The best purpose of Vedic culture is served, however, by chanting the holy name of the Lord, as recommended by Lord Chaitanya, the deliverer of all fallen souls. When Lord Chaitanya was asked by a great Vedic scholar, Prakashananda Saraswati, why he, the Lord, was chanting the holy name of the Lord like a sentimentalist instead of studying Vedanta philosophy, the Lord replied that his spiritual master had found him to be a great fool and thus asked him to chant the holy name of Lord Krishna. He did so and became ecstatic like a madman. In this age of Kali, most of the population is foolish and not adequately educated to understand Vedanta philosophy. The best purpose of Vedanta philosophy is served by inoffensively chanting the holy name of the Lord. Vedanta is the last word in Vedic wisdom, and the author and knower of the Vedanta philosophy is Lord Krishna, and the highest Vedantist is the great soul who takes pleasure in chanting the holy name of the Lord. That is the ultimate purpose of all Vedic mysticism. Just before I get to the subject of this class, I'll just make a small point about this edition of Bhagavad Gita as it is. It's written original edition. Actually, the original edition was the first one that was published was an abridged edition. So it's not really, if you want to be technically correct, it's not the original edition. On Sunday, I was reading, it was covered with a paper, so I couldn't tell which it, from the outside what it was. And I came across something in the purport that was in the, I spoke on chapter 4, text 3, where, and I saw something in the purport, I thought, that doesn't sound right. It said about Arjuna becoming a devotee of Krishna. I thought, that's not right. Arjuna's an eternal associate. And then, so I thought I'd write to Dravida Prabhu, because I, whenever I find things which seem a bit odd in the Veda base, I write to him. So I looked, and then in the Veda base they have the current edition, and I saw it said about Arjuna being a devotee of Krishna. So it said that that so many changes have been made, but some of them are, if not many of them, if not all of them, are good. Because Srila Prabhupada again and again writes that Arjuna is an internal associate of Krishna. So he wouldn't want to. And of course, the Bhagavad Gita, what Srila Prabhupada dictated, we don't have the original dictation. We have the transcription. And then in the transcription, there were so many mistakes. Now in this verse also, here's a small thing. Here we see in the word-for-word translation, udapane. There's a hyphen there. So it's more technically correct than in the 1972 edition, I think, which we have here, in which there's no hyphen. From the point of view of presenting the Sanskrit, it's supposed to be word by word, so that's actually two words, but it's joined together in one word, so it's more technically correct. Another thing is, in this original edition, if you want, all the purposes of the Vedas can be, can at once be served by the great reservoirs of water. Now, if you see the translation here, it says, by a great reservoir of water, which not only follows the Sanskrit better, but it also makes more sense. Because we're not talking about, the Vedas is one great body of knowledge. It's not that there are others. Let's read from the Vedas today and we'll read from the Mao Zedong's Little Red Book tomorrow. It's specifically referring to the Vedas. So I'm not in the league which is demanding that we get back to the edition with the planet of the trees. That's maybe the funniest example. What is that? Pitrinam Aryama Chasmi. Among the Pitris, I am Aryama. And the poor devotee who was transcribing, or maybe it was Neil, who wasn't even a devotee. He was a college student who was typing. He didn't know what Pitris are, so he thought Prabhupada must have meant trees. So maybe there is a planet of trees somewhere out there in the universe, but that's not what Prabhupada was referring to. There are others also. Anyway, I'll just say one more funny one. Hayagriva Prabhu was editing, and when Srila Prabhupada writes about cleanliness, he says about regularly bathing, shaving, but Hayagriva had a big beard. In the early days, devotees weren't required to shave their, many of them were hippies before and they had big beards. So he hadn't shaved his beard off and he didn't want to, so he shaved out the word shaving. It got restored later. Okay, so let's get on with the discussion of this verse. I'm very much into, among others, I'm very much into doing what I can to try to fulfill Srila Prabhupada's oft-stated desire to re-establish Varnashram Dharma in human society. Now, as we learn from this purport, although the word Varnashram isn't specifically mentioned, but you can go back to Godhead without Varnashram Dharma. It is extraneous to pure devotional service. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu required from Ramananda Rai about sadhya sadhana tattva, what is the goal of life and how to attain it, Ramananda first of all offered that we should perform, worship Vishnu according to Varnashram duties. Varnashrama charavata purushena parapuman Vishnu ra radyate panta nanyat tatto shakaranam. He said that, quoting from the Vishnu Purana, a highly respected shastra, maybe after Srimad Bhagavatam, must be, well, the most important of the Puranas, we can say. So in there it's stated that one should follow the Varnashram duties and thus worship Vishnu, and there's no other way to satisfy him. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejected this. Eho bahya, age kohoa. This is external, tell me something else. So it is external to pure devotional service. In pure devotional service, there's no need for Varnashram Dharma. Just like for a person who has an injury, he may need to walk with a stick. But when it becomes cured, he doesn't need it anymore. And there are examples in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Haridas Thakur, he was outside the Varnashram system. Rup and Sanatan, they were outside the Varnashram system. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself lived as a Grihastha. Then he took sannyas, which is within the Varnashram system. But anyway, there are, you can go back to Godhead without Varnashram. And we have in the Western world devotees who have not followed Varnashram and they've passed away from this world in Vrindavan, surrounded by devotees, chanting the holy names, and according to all Shastric understanding, they must have gone back to Godhead. So you can go back to Godhead without Varnashram. And even we're warned that attachment to Varnashram can be a blockage in devotional service. If one is thinking, I am a Brahmin, or I'm a Shudra, if you identify with the body in any way, that is a blockage in devotional service. But on the other hand, just like the example of the cripple, as long as a healthy person doesn't need a stick to walk with, but a crippled person does, so that he can get better, so that he can operate in the world and gradually recover. So in the same way, Varnashram is a social system. People have to live according to some social system. If we don't follow Varnashram Dharma, then we're going to follow something else. And Varnashram is the most conducive for practicing Krishna consciousness, Vedic culture. So that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejects it as external, it doesn't mean that he totally rejects it in all respects. And of course, our recent acharyas beginning from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, have been very eager to re-establish Varnashram Dharma, especially in India. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes about that. Now, I'm particularly bringing this up. We're talking about, Srila Prabhupada writes here about the Vedic rituals as being external or unnecessary. Particularly referring to the Karma Kanda portion of the Vedas, there are so many rituals to follow. And actually in Varnashram's Dharma, there are many rules to follow. And the higher up you go, the more rules there are. The Brahmins have many rules. The Shudras also have many rules compared to people living nowadays. Srila Prabhupada, he used to say that all people today are Shudras. That's a compliment to most people. People who are outside Varnashram society, they don't have to follow any rules. They can have mead, illicit sex, gambling if they have anything to gamble, intoxicate, they can do that. And they also have a function to follow because they'll take away, they'll carry dead bodies, take out dead cows and things like that. They also have a function, but they live outside civilized society. Now everyone has a role to play, but those who are brahmanas, those who are close to God, it's considered, and they literally, they can come close to the deities in the temples. They have to follow more rules, because if we're going to approach God, we're going to have to be careful. Narendra Modi is coming to Mangalore in a few days. At least the plan is that. So in the unlikely event of anyone here meeting him, it's not that you just walk up to him and blow your nose like that and cough in his face. You'd have to follow a certain protocol because he's a very important and respectable person. And to not treat him with the utmost respect would be extremely rude. Of course, other politicians do so all the time in other parties, but even they, I hope, when they meet him, would personally, they would treat him with some respect, because that's proper human behavior. So what to speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? There are so many rules, and in the Karma Kanda and the Jnana Kanda and the Upasana Kanda and in Bhakti, those who they're all followers of the Vedic culture, and so they all follow many rules for regulating every part of one's life, everything that's done in Vedic culture. For instance, if you're going to build a house, there's so many considerations: the land. What is the inclination of the land? Then how he should be facing which direction? Where the kitchen should be? Where the bathroom should be? Right? In Vedic culture, they said where the no, there's no bathroom. There's no place for passing stool or urine in a house. That's not done in a house. That's outside. If you pass stool in a house, then you can't cook there or worship the deities because it's all contaminated according to the old system. You have to go outside. Now this, yeah, so what I'm saying is that all these things are followed. Yeah, and then at what time, the time that you have to start the construction has to be astrologically considered. Whether to build a house there at all or not, you have to astrologically ascertain. And then you have to, if before building anything, you have to see the cows graze there for some time. There's so many things to be followed. And in everything, even in passing urine there are, and stool, there are so many rules. Now, I happened to mention this recently in Mayapur. I gave a 3-day series of talks titled Understanding and Appreciating understanding and applying Srila Prabhupada's teachings. And just at the end of the 3 days, I mentioned something that, well, in Varnashram Dharma, there are even rules for, if we're going to institute Varnashram Dharma in society, then we're going to get back to the old rules, such as which direction to face when you're passing urine or stool. So you might think, well, which direction is it? It's not fixed. It depends on the time of day. And even the time of day, if it's the right direction, if that happens to be facing toward a Vishnu temple, then you can't do it. So there are so many considerations. Now, one of my godbrothers, who's been preaching in America pretty much all his life, I had a little exchange with him by email, and he thought this thing about, you know, this is just silly. Just silly, you know, why should, you know. He made a slightly sarcastic comment. He just said, that's a silly little thing. You can pass urine in any direction, and you can still go back to Godhead. He didn't say all of that. He didn't say all of that, but there was a little sarcasm there. So it's true that you can. And he said, when I get back to Godhead, they can teach me all the rules. Something like that, he said. In other words, the idea is just a silly, trivial thing. And when I was first in India, I first came in 1976 for 6 weeks only, but then I came in 1977 to stay, which I have done more or less since then, if you include Southeast Asia as an extension of India. I was 10 years in Bangladesh, Thailand, and all those places. But there's actually quite a lot of Vedic culture in Thailand. Well, something. Anyway, more than in America, that's for sure. So when I first came, one of the things we used to hear from young people at that time, we used to hear a lot, especially young people, was talking about all these rituals, Hinduism, rituals. Yeah, there was so much propaganda. Young people and even middle-aged people, Pandit Nehru, great disaster that he became the first. Anyway, he's an agent of Kali, so it's Kali Yuga. He became the first Prime Minister of India with an anti-Vedic agenda. With the idea openly stated that the factories and the dams will be the temples of new India, modern India. And if you trace it further, you can find this goes back to Swami Vivekananda with this idea, nationhood, build a nation, all rubbish ideas. Anyway, so what is all this ritual? Because at that time still, many people, they followed many rituals, but they didn't know why. And the priests, they were called priests, means Brahmins, and they'd chant mantras. And the Brahmins didn't know what the mantras meant. One time I asked, there was a Brahmin chanting some mantras. I asked him, he was a young man. This was many years ago. I said, what does that mean? He said, I don't know. I just, my father, karma kandi, my father taught me to chant this when I do this. I don't know. And there's that idea actually in the Karma Mimamsa that you don't have to know what it means. If you chant the Vedic mantras exactly according to all the rules and regulations, you get the result. So what do you need to know what it means or anything? Anti-philosophy. So that idea is all these rituals, they're all silly little things. What does it matter which way you face when you pass urine? But we should know that this is all given by Krishna. It all has a purpose. We may not know what the purpose is, but it all has a purpose. One thing is, that one the idea of giving a specific direction is, well, there are various reasons. One reason is that we should not face the sun or moon when we're urinating, right? That makes sense. And then we have a sense, oh, sun, that's Surya Dev. Huh? So it's not just something which makes us hot, but that's a person to be respected. So in this way, there's so many rules, they reinforce the consciousness that we live in a universe where there is higher powers who are overseeing everything, and we are subordinate. And we should respect those higher powers in everything we're doing. It's not that, well, we're devotees of Krishna, what the hell do we care about the sun god? It's not like that. We should not. In fact, that's stated among the 64 rules that Srila Rupa Goswami gives for sadhana bhakti. One should not disrespect the demigods. We don't regularly worship them, but we don't disrespect them. And they're everywhere. Even when one rises in the morning, first one has to say a prayer to Bhumi Devi before we put our foot on the ground. Everyone used to do. We're putting our foot. She's our worshipable mother. But we have to put our foot on her. So there's a prayer that, please forgive me for stepping on, because there's no choice but to do that. So in everything, from the very beginning of the day, we remember who we are. There's a very much conscious of direction, of time. Time means, if we have Gaurabdha, for instance, then we remember that it's the year after the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then whether we're in Uttarayana or Dakshinayanam, there are different considerations, and then whether we're in which month we're in. Each month is presided over by a different demigod, and actually by Vishnu, different forms of Vishnu. You'll find that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that's stated. Different forms of Vishnu preside over different months. And then there's the Krishna Paksha, the dark fortnight of the months. And Krishna refers to, in the Bhagavad Gita, to Krishna Paksha and Shukla Paksha, the light fortnight. And after the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we like to say Gaura Paksha. Remember Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? Like this. And then there are different days and there are different duties for different days. We remember that mostly for Ekadashi, fasting. And on certain days, women will fast. They don't do that nowadays. Not much. Fast for the benefit of their husband. So many things. So many. Much consciousness of direction and time, so that we have an understanding. Here we are in the universe, a very small being with tremendous powers all around, who are coordinating everything. Another thing is the science of omens, shakun, that's called. Science, if you believe in science, you won't believe in this. If you see a cat passing in front of you, or you see when you come out of the house, you see someone is carrying a full pot of water, some things are auspicious, some things are inauspicious. You say, well, pff, well, pff. That's nonsense, a materialist would say. But we know that everything in the universe is connected. It's all orchestrated by Krishna. And Krishna has given this science of omen, so that certain event, it predicts or it gives an indication of something that's about us, something in general. Just like if you hear thunder in the distance, you can expect there will be a storm fairly soon. But if you're really expert, you'll know whether there's going to be a storm or not. Because sometimes there's thunder and there's not a storm. If you're living in the country, you'll probably know this very well. In the city, you wouldn't even hear it because of the traffic noises. It's just like I gave that example the other day. Was that here? I can't remember. I gave it just here on Sunday. That Srila Prabhupada had mentioned he was with a doctor friend in Dhaka, which is now the capital of Bangladesh, and one old man coughed in their presence, and then the doctor said to Prabhupada, who at that time was Abhay Babu, that by the way he's coughing, I can understand he's going to die very soon. So everyone would hear him coughing. Anyone could hear him coughing, but a doctor would know by the sound that this presages his death. So in the same way, there are so many omens, and there are so many kinds of things. In Vedic physiognomy, you can see from the face where if the eyebrows are joined together, where they're apart, how high the forehead is, and then if one toe is out of sequence, if it's longer than another, it all gives ideas of the personality. That's why Shukdev, when he came into the assembly on the bank of the Ganga, then everyone stood up, even though he was a young boy, but by seeing him, they could understand he's a great personality. And that's those lakshanams, characteristics of a great personality, they are described in the Samudrika, which is part of Garuda Purana. And then you'll get so many interesting things in Garuda Purana. So it's meaningful. It's not meaningless. And it's all part of Vedic culture to know these things. Not everyone can know everything. There are specialists also. But the point is that the Vedic rules, they're not whimsical or arbitrary. There are just so many, why are all these rules? Why are all these rituals? What does it matter? No, there's a point. Now, here in this purport, Srila Prabhupada quotes from the Srimad Bhagavatam that someone who's always chanting the holy names of Krishna, they're already on the highest platform. They've already done all the Vedic rituals. They've done whatever needs to be done. So the implication is that you don't need to do all these things. And actually, a pure devotee might not follow all these things. In Karma Kanda, one will not face the sun while urinating out of a sense of respect for the sun, but also out of fear of committing offense, of committing sin and getting punished. Whereas a devotee, he may not face the sun because he recognizes that, not that he's particularly afraid of sin, because he's dedicated his life to Krishna, and Krishna can send him to heaven or to hell. That's the attitude of a pure devotee. But he doesn't want to offend the sun because he knows the sun is a representative of Krishna. So they both do the same thing, but maybe for different reasons. Now, a Paramahamsa Vaishnava doesn't need to follow all these rules. There's a term, avadhut, means one who's completely cleansed and purified. He can do no wrong. Just like a child can do no wrong. A child of 6 months, his sense of right and wrong is not developed. So he can do no wrong. If a child accidentally presses a button by which, the house is closed and you can't get into the house, something like that. They have, in America, you push the button and the garage opens. Maybe the child will push the button and the garage opens and then thieves come in and steal things. But you don't punish the child. The child doesn't have a sense of what should be done and what should not be done. And a topmost Paramahamsa may not have that sense because they're totally absorbed in love of Krishna. There are a few like that. Vamsidas Babaji was like that. he was just totally absorbed in love of Krishna. So he didn't follow the rules and regulations of deity worship. He treated his deities like a father or mother would treat naughty children, and he would punish them, and he would feed them whenever he got some food, he would feed them. He would go out begging, and one time he punished them by not feeding them for a few days because he went out begging, and then he came back to his little kuti and all his cooking utensils were stolen. So he says, "Your fault, I left you here guarding them. So now I can't cook, so you're not going to eat for a few days," which meant that he also didn't eat for a few days. But anyway, that's unusual. Ordinarily, pure devotees also follow that to teach others. One thing is, just like the example of the sun, a pure devotee doesn't want to disrespect the sun. And also to teach others, because if people prematurely think that I'm on a stage where I'm a devotee, so I don't need to follow all these things. Srila Prabhupada actually rebuked one disciple who referred to himself. He wrote a poem and he sent it to Prabhupada. It was a poem addressed to Krishna. "I am your devotee, Krishna." And Prabhupada said, a devotee doesn't think he's a devotee. Just like we hear. Someone said, "Well, I became a devotee so many years ago." Or someone asked me, "When did you become a devotee?" So often I'm asked, my reply, "Well, I'm still trying. I can't say I became a devotee." So a devotee doesn't think he's a devotee. So a topmost devotee will follow the rules to teach others, not to to follow what they need to follow. Others, devotees, may not be on the topmost Paramahamsa platform, but they may not follow all the rules and regulations, especially if they're preaching. For instance, it often happens that we're busy in preaching through the whole sandhya and we don't get to chant Gayatri in the proper time. That doesn't become an offense because we're absorbed in preaching. Just like the talk is scheduled just before the sandhya begins, and so we don't have time during the sandhya. We can't stop in the middle of the talk and just say, "I'm just stopping for a few minutes." For preaching, you may have to break so many rules. You may be in a train traveling here and there to go someplace for preaching, and then you're supposed to stop and chant Gayatri, but what do you do if you're in a train and you're on a 24-hour train journey, and then what do? You can't stop chanting Gayatri. So the rules may be broken due to circumstances, and that often arises, especially in preaching. If one stays in one place, in a fixed place, it's much easier to lead a regulated life and follow all the rules. Another reason not to follow is just because we're just not capable. And that was very much the case with most of Srila Prabhupada's disciples. And he actually wrote in one purport that about Indian people criticizing because the Western devotees don't follow so many rules. And he stated in one place that the Westerners, they can never follow all these things. And we're in the Western countries especially, and increasingly so in India, people are so far away from the Vedic culture that they simply can't relate to it. Just like my godbrother wrote sarcastically about which direction you face. And you can understand that because even in India, and that was a great ambition of the Modi government, I don't know if that was fulfilled, to make toilets in every house, right? So that people don't have to go outside to pass stool and urine. Some years ago, I was in one state in America, I think it was North Carolina, and some devotees were building a house. I said, why don't you put the toilet outside and not attached to the house? Even in English, there's a term, outhouse. It used to be that the houses were built with the toilets just outside. But then the devotee told me, no, there's a law in this state. You have to have a toilet attached to the house. Otherwise, you can't get permission to build. You have to submit the plans for building, and a toilet has to be there. So if you have a fixed toilet, it could be pretty difficult to get the right direction, because it's pretty much fixed which direction you'll be in. And people have no idea of going outside to pass. They have no idea. You pass stool and you're in a toilet, that's all. They have no idea that anything else is possible, and they consider anything else to be uncivilized. Actually, it's civilized to go outside and pass. But in Kali Yuga, if you pass next to the kitchen, that's considered civilized, in the bathroom. Well, they have the bathroom next to the kitchen. That's considered very civilized. Some things of Indian culture are going on which Westerners still can't relate to. Not very long ago, maybe a year and a half ago, some issue came up in the news, how I believe it was Amazon was marketing doormats. You know what a doormat is? There's a doormat. It's when you come in the house and there's mud on your shoes and you wipe your shoes on the doormat so the mud comes off, and then when you walk in the house with your shoes, which is standard in Western culture, then mud doesn't come in the house. So Amazon was marketing doormats with the Indian flag on it. I think it was the Indian flag. And when this came to the attention of Indians, they became incensed, because it is extremely insulting in Indian culture to put your foot on something which is considered sacred. And in modern India, the Indian flag is considered sacred. And the company marketing that in Amazon, they couldn't relate to it at all. What's the problem for them? They think it's promoting India. So if you like India, you have a doormat with Indian flag. Maybe they made it especially for Indian people. Maybe they did it in all countries. But it became such an issue that I believe who is that? Sushma Swaraj, she's the home minister, is it? Is it? Foreign minister. Anyway, she made a complaint, and Amazon had the good sense from a commercial point of view to withdraw it. But just I'm making that little point that there are certain things in Indian culture, even today, which Indians relate to, and Westerners can't understand it at all. But even if, and like I say, modern Indians might not understand that either, because which direction you face whichever direction the toilet is in. You go in and you don't have any, if you go into a public toilet and you face the wrong direction, it goes all over the floor, you can't even think of doing it. It seems ridiculous. So if we can't understand it, we shouldn't denigrate it, because it is, after all, given by Krishna. And as far as possible, at least in India, we should try to revive that great culture. And we may say, well, that's not very, we want to make things complicated. Let's just keep it simple. But you can also consider that all the acharyas and all the great Vaishnavas previously did follow all these things. And one would not be considered fit to worship the deities unless he followed all these things. Even the Shudras would follow things like not facing the sun while passing urine. And what to speak of the Brahmanas? It's only the Chandals who wouldn't follow such things. Such Chandalas can become completely purified if they're always chanting the holy name of Krishna, to the extent that they can also perform Vedic sacrifices, theoretically, but they'd have to be trained before they did so. because Vedic sacrifice require proper pronunciation. Even if one is chanting the holy names, it requires a lot of training to offer sacrifice. For chanting the holy names, there are no fixed rules concerning desha kala niyam nahi. Kayate shuite jota tota namaloi desha kala niyam nahi. Sharva shiddhi hoi, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, that even while eating, even while lying down, one can chant the holy names of Krishna. There are no considerations of time or place. One can get all perfection in all circumstances. So it's not possible to perform a Vedic fire sacrifice while eating at the same time, popping some potato chips in your mouth or swaha. It's not possible. Or if you get tired, you lie down and put the ghee in the fire. It's not possible. You can't do that. Theoretically, you can do while chanting the holy names, but actually, even in shastras, it's recommended that you sit down while chanting. Eating is time and place for everything. But the idea is that the holy name is so merciful that even without following all these rules, we can get all perfection. That doesn't mean, again, doesn't mean that the rules are unimportant. So we should try to revive Varnashram, right? Because Srila Prabhupada wanted that, and he wanted it for a specific reason. Even before he came to the West, he was writing about that. He was writing about that because Bhaktivinoda Thakur wanted that to be properly. He was the first one to write about that, as far as I know. There may have been others. And Srila Prabhupada also wanted to do that. And Srila Prabhupada very much linked the Varnashram revival with farm projects. Although Varnashram can be followed not only in farms, because in Vedic culture there are cities also. But Srila Prabhupada particularly wanted to make that on the farm projects, because if we make farm projects, then we can make our own society, our own villages. And Mayapur, he wanted to be a Vedic city also. But he said no more than 50,000 population. So that, and even in that, in Mayapur, in the original plans that Prabhupada approved, there were to be separate living quarters for Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. That devotees don't know nowadays, but if you look in the old Bhakti Godheads before Srila Prabhupada passed away, then you'll find that. Srila Prabhupada wanted it. Even before he came to the West, he spoke of that. But from the early 1970s on, he spoke of it with more insistence, seeing that many of his Western disciples, well, actually most of it, the great majority of Prabhupada's disciples were Westerners anyway, they were falling away from devotional service and back into their old bad habits. So Varnashram, by being properly situated in one's proper occupation according to one's psychophysical propensities, then that helps to be Krishna conscious, to be Krishna conscious, and it also helps us to remain steady and have a regulated life on the farms. That's very easy. In the farm, if there's no electricity, then there's no electric lights, then automatically you take rest early, automatically you rise early. Whereas in the city, it doesn't really matter. You can stay up as late as you like. And have all the facilities of daytime. But if there's no electricity, then you don't get all of that. So it's very in so many ways it's very conducive for Krishna consciousness. So Srila Prabhupada wanted that revived. And the point that I was making when I mentioned this, it's not that I hope I'm not a fanatic about passing urine in the right direction. We shouldn't be fanatical about the rules, but I'm just making the point that Vedic society is a very rule-conscious society because there are rules to govern every aspect of life, and those rules are to help to situate us properly with respect to the whole universe and to make us aware that we are tiny living beings within the universe. We're not the controllers of the universe. And therefore, those rules are, if we can institute it, it's good. If we can't, then just chant Hare Krishna. But if we can do, it will be helpful. And actually, it's not very difficult to remember and do it. If you're outside, it's not very difficult to do it. It's just like, for instance, learning to drive. There are certain things you learn to drive, and then when you've learned it, you've learned it. And it becomes very easy, and you don't really think about it much. When you're learning, you have to think, handbrake and gearbox and accelerator and this and that, and how to coordinate, how do you coordinate the gears and the steering wheels. But after some time becomes very, in the beginning you have to think about it, but after some time becomes just, you don't even have to think about it, it becomes very easy. So Varnashram, it actually means a lot more than simply designating people as Brahmana, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, and Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis, and women, because there's a whole different consideration for women in many ways. So if we can institute that much in the West, that'll be good. In India, we should try for more, because it's possible here. Prabhupada writes in one place that at any time the Varnashram system can be revived in India. So we should try to do that. Unfortunately, Indian people are not very conscious or aware or of the importance of their own culture. Thanks to the British and their acolytes like Pandit Nehru, and many others up to the present day, such as, there are so many, Romila Thapar, and then, who's that? Is she Arundhati Roy? And they're big scholars with a Western, Indian with Western mindset who are against the Vedic culture and influential. So Indian people, it's been Hindus, it's been systematically inculcated in them that this culture is nonsense, and they're very eager to follow the Western culture and not very eager to follow the Indian culture, the traditional Vedic culture. And when I attend, we have Shravan Kirtan comes in different places, we have a rule. Men in dhotis, no silly t-shirts with silly things written on it. And for women, saris, not salwar kameez. For unmarried girls, okay, but not for married women. So we have some rules. And some devotees, they don't like that. Dhoti? I don't want to wear a dhoti. They feel embarrassed to wear a dhoti. Why? That's a Prabhupada wore a dhoti. And even in the Western countries, there's some big propaganda in our movement. Dhoti, they don't need dhoti. Forget it. They don't need dhotis. We'll wear jeans. That's sattvic. It's supposed to be sattvic, according to some people. Even though they're produced in hellish sweatshops by underpaid workers, somehow it's sattvic. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he put a lot of stress on proper Vaishnava dress. In one of his songs, he mentions about the favorable activities for Krishna consciousness. And one of them, he says that Gaura Bhakata Priya Vesha Dadhana Tilak Tulasi Mala Shobhamana. One of the favorable activities is to dress in the way that is dear to the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and to be beautified by Tilak and Tulsi Mala. And many places. Recently I was going through the Godruma Kalpatavi of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which at least twice he mentions that the members of the Namahatta, they should dress properly like devotees. So anyway, that's just one point, that dress is important. Everything in Vedic culture is important. We may have to make adjustments for preaching. That's a fact. In the Western countries, we're not preaching that you have to wear a dhoti. We're preaching you have to chant Hare Krishna. If someone wants to wear pants and chant Hare Krishna, great. That's a huge, huge step up from wearing pants and not chanting Hare Krishna. But if we actually want to identify with Krishna and Krishna's culture, then we will like to follow all the principles of that culture. So, at least here in India, we should try to do that, to reintroduce that. Unfortunately, Srila Prabhupada's Varnashram initiative is largely forgotten, or to be more precise, suppressed within our society. But Srila Prabhupada wanted it, and it should be done. Even we may introduce minor things for those who are ready for it. A little over, there's one farm community that I regularly visit in Gujarat, devotees there. So the devotees there, they introduced in the temple the screen curtain to separate the men and the women. And I thought, this is too much. The women will protest. But actually they like it. Everyone likes it. So at least in India we could do these things. I think in the West, if you try to introduce this, I don't know how well it would go. Maybe, because when I was a child, I used to go to the Catholic Church, and the men would sit on one side and the women on the other. And the rule was that the women would cover their head. Yeah, in the Catholic Church. And the men would not cover their head. That was the etiquette that everyone followed. So I don't think it's impossible to introduce in the Western countries, because it's actually natural for, and now we're getting into another topic, but it's actually natural for women to, there may be some exceptions, but it's natural for them to want to be somewhat shy and to defer to men. Anyway, we're getting into another topic. And if you try to preach this in the West among certain people, you are in for a lot of vilification. Maybe in India also. But still, we have to, because people don't like it, doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it or try to introduce it. People don't, if Prabhupada thought that, well, people won't like it, so I shouldn't go to the West and preach, then we wouldn't all be here today. I'd probably be dead in this body, actually. Probably. Quite likely, as would many of my godbrothers who are still alive due to the bad habits that we were addicted to. It's quite possible. Anyway, there's a huge body of topics and to discuss here, but I'm just giving a little idea of why that comment I made, that in the Varnashram society that we want to introduce, which direction you face while passing urine, it's also part of the things that we can introduce, because devotees actually want to follow. In those farms we're doing, the devotees, well, they want to follow, because they know this is the culture, that we've left that hellish city culture, and we want to follow this culture, Krishna's culture. So they want to do that. in details. We don't want to become rule conscious. We always have to remember that it's all for Krishna's pleasure. Krishna te kila cheshta. And when we follow this, we're following it because we know in a small way that will please Krishna. Definitely chanting the holy names is the way to please him the most. But if we're attentive to small in every detail of our life, we're always thinking how to please Krishna. And the Vedic rules give us the opportunity to do that. So I'm just making that point because definitely, especially to many devotees in the West, it will just seem completely absurd to them why we should be interested to introduce rules which, to their understanding, have absolutely no meaning or utility whatsoever. But my point is they do have meaning and utility. They're not the main thing by any means, but they do have meaning and utility. So, Hare Krishna. Any question? Economy in Varnashram is centered around the cows, yeah. Cows and land? Actually, in every culture, it's centered around the cows and the land. Because that's the most basic commodity that everyone needs is food. It's just that in modern life, in city life, we don't see that. But in city life, if the food supply stops within 2 or 3 days, it'll be a total disaster. So people don't see it, but actually the whole economy everywhere is based on food. That's the first basic necessity. That first, when we're talking about economy, we're talking about production and consumption. So you may say, well, air is the first basic necessity, but that's there. You don't have to do anything to get it. So the first basic necessity is to arrange for is food. So it's true in every culture.
Cows,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now we're getting into a big area of topics. If we're going to discuss the details of establishing Varnashram, it's a big, big thing. Cow culture, as it was practiced in India until recently, it's difficult to do so as it was previously. One major reason is because the forests are all cut down and the common land is encroached on, the grazing land. Doesn't cost anything to keep a cow if you have grazing land. If you don't, then you have to grow or buy feed. So it makes it economically, unless you're very economically conscious, it's economically unviable to keep a cow. That's a fact in most parts of the world. So I gave a talk on this a few years ago called The Money Culture, in which the whole world is running on the money culture. Everything's in terms of money. When you see a cow, when a farmer sees a cow, he doesn't see my mother, he sees money. Is it a profit or a loss? When the milking rate goes down, sell the cow for slaughter. I can't afford to keep anymore. Anyway, it's a huge area of topics, which I won't get into more now. Hare Krishna. Mancha kalpatarubhyas chakripa sindhu vyavacha. Patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha.